is a piece of music from the Baal Shem Suite by Ernest Bloch. And the soloist playing on the mandolin is Avi Avital. Avi Avital has performed all over the world, in New York's Carnegie Hall and in the Forbidden City in Beijing. And in 2009, Avi performed this piece in a villa just outside Berlin, the villa at Wannsee. It's a beautiful place with a hideous history, because it was there that senior Nazi officials signed off on what they called the final solution to the Jewish problem. It was the document that put the Holocaust in motion. The mandolin has a typically sweet sound, which has always made it popular as a folk instrument. It's an instrument that can speak of lost love and pain and longing for home. But Avi Avital is able to draw out a really rich emotional range with the mandolin and using it within the classical repertoire. Avi Avital is touring Australia at the moment with the Australian Brandenburg Orchestra. Hi, Avi.
Hello.
Tell me about the mandolin you brought with you today. It's a beautiful instrument. How old is it?
Yeah, not that old if you consider other musical instruments. This one is from 98, so it's 18 years old. I had it last year of high school. It's the best mandolin I have held in my life until now.
And there are double strings. Are the strings the same note or are they an octave apart?
They're the same note, yeah.
And what does the double string do for the mandolin, to its sound?
Yeah, that's the characteristic of the sound of the mandolin. I think if I break a string in a concert, you would hear the difference because the sound would be thinner. Although they're tuned exactly the same, they're not playing the same frequencies exactly. So it gives a little bit of a chorus effect to that and make the sound a little bit thicker.
Do you see the mandolin as having a very broad emotional range? Or is it more like something that shines in a narrow emotional range?
Oh, endless. Really? Emotional range, absolutely, yeah. The mandolin still, in some parts of the world, by some people, is considered somehow a limited instrument. It was always associated as an amateur instrument, historically, since its birth in the 17th century in Italy. It was always somehow associated with more kind of an amateur playing. And that's why people didn't take it very seriously, including great composers who never wrote for the mandolin. But also, at the same time, it's very much associated with folk music. And so people tend to look this way at the mandolin. And I had the luck to never study with a mandolin teacher. In other words, I had, throughout my education in Israel, violin teachers as my tutors, just because we didn't have a mandolin teacher in where I grew up. So I wanted to play the mandolin. There wasn't a mandolin teacher. There you go, violin teacher. Teach me music.
I've heard you, as a soloist, performing Summer from Vivaldi's Four Seasons. And, you know, when I've heard that in the past, with the violin as a solo instrument, it's very glossy. It's got the kind of a sheen to it. With mandolin as a solo instrument, there's all these other things. It gives it a kind of, I don't know, some other a feeling, some kind of a different kind of emotional range.
I mean, the reason I decided to play the Four Seasons, especially the Summer, which I also recorded, I mean, it's the most recorded piece of music in the history. Everyone heard it, whether they liked it or not, on CDs, on LPs, on commercials, on ringtones. And that was exactly the point. I wanted to reconstruct the feeling of listening to this extremely famous piece of music for the first time. You know, I've been to Venice many times. And Piazza San Marco is stunning. It's just the most beautiful thing on earth. I've been there every time I was in Venice, but it's always that first time you saw it. The first time I was in Piazza San Marco, that was something else. And I think in the back of my mind, I wanted to reconstruct for people an experience and listening experience like they rediscover, like it's the first time they listen.
When the violin is played as a solo instrument, you've got the bow, and so you can have these long, sustained notes. Can you show me how you do that on a mandolin? Because you don't have a bow, and it's playing a sustained note's got to be achieved in a different way.
There are several ways, actually. There are a million ways of achieving a sustained note. The most familiar one is the tremolo.
Mm-hmm.
But it depends. Sometimes the tremolo you see is also very sentimental. For example, when I play Bach music, even if I have to sustain a longer note, I would never use the tremolo because Bach's music is not sentimental. It's like beyond that. So there I would just... You know, it sustains, actually.
Avi, you grew up in Israel, in the town of Be'er Sheva, on the edge of the Negev Desert. What kind of musical traditions had sort of met in Be'er Sheva?
Yeah, well, Be'er Sheva, I grew up in the 80s, and Be'er Sheva, like the entire country, Israel, is a melting pot, is a mixed salad of cultures and of musics and cuisines and you name it. So my parents, for example, both were born in Morocco. They brought their music from home, which was Moroccan music, especially you hear in bar mitzvahs and weddings and in the synagogue and so on. My friends are from Poland or from Germany or from America or from India. Different music, different food on the table.
And what language was spoken around the family home? Was it Arabic or Hebrew? Or
that's another interesting thing, because my parents, although their mother tongue was Moroccan, a dialect of Arabic, when they came to Israel, they switched it off in a way. And they spoke with us Hebrew. We spoke only Hebrew at home. This is their first language now. Yeah, they only used Moroccan when they didn't want us to understand as kids. Yeah.
How close is the Negev Desert to the city limits of Be'er Sheva?
Oh, just when you bypass the last house in Be'er Sheva, and you're
right
in the desert. Yeah.
So it's like an Australian outback town like that.
In that sense, I guess,
as well. And does that mean you kind of interact with Bedouin culture around in the desert?
Yes, indeed. The Bedouin culture is a very unique one. Their hospitality is the highest value. I remember one time we got a flat tire outside of the city. I was with my uncle and with my father, and remember, you know, a Bedouin kid running up and like inviting us to his family tent and helping us with a tire and making us coffee, and it was amazing. And also the music is amazing. They have this musical instrument, which is also what you use to grind coffee. By grinding it, you make all kinds of rhythms.
And you make coffee with a percussion instrument, right?
Exactly. Wow. How great is that?
All right, so it's music's really embedded, interwoven in the fabric of everyday life.
Yes, and I feel grateful for that, because I realized that I lived in with so many musical genres and functions, and although my education was classical, I was always influenced and keep absorbing other uses of music, other functions, and other, you know, colors and smells and sounds from different cultures, and it really all sums up when I play, whether I play jazz or world music, or when I play Vivaldi. I feel how this Bedouin experience of rhythmical thing that always they also use it to communicate to the next tent or the next village thing. So you have rhythms that are connected with weddings or funeral and so on. So yeah, I feel very blessed by having this enormous amount of music around me.
So with the mandolin, was it something you heard and went, oh, I've got to have that? Or was it more like someone said, here's a mandolin, young man, why don't you fool around with that for a bit?
Definitely the first one. First time I saw a mandolin was at my neighbor's house. I know, I was 8 years old. I think I just really liked it. There's something very immediate you have to see in the mandolin. I see it now with kids that I play to them, and it's very easy to make your first sound with it.
It's not like a bow.
It's not like a violin that you have to put the shoulder rest and know how to hold a bow and so on. It's, I think, for restless kids like I was, there was something in the kind of an immediate reaction of it that that grabbed me, and that's how I started.
You mentioned you had a teacher who was actually a violin teacher. What was his story?
And he was an immigrant from Russia, from St. Petersburg, coming to Be'er Sheva in the 70s. So Be'er Sheva is not like Tel Aviv or Jerusalem. It's pretty provincial and a little bit cut off from the center. It used to be, at least. And he came to the local conservatory and said, hello, I'm a big teacher from St. Petersburg of the violin. Can you give me a job? And they say, well, you know, we have already a violin teacher. sorry, but if you want, you can stay and teach the mandolin because we have like 30 mandolins in the basement. We don't know what to do with them. And so he did. Very philosophical, very spiritual way approach to music. You know, a typical thing, just to illustrate, I would go to my teacher and ask him to, you know, I wanted to work on Bach Chaconne, one of the monumental pieces by Bach originally for violin. And he says like, yes, but first you have to read this book and to read those poems. And he would give me, you know, names of poets and told me to memorize every morning one line of a poem.
So after you did your military service, you went to Italy. Why Italy? Why did you want to go there?
Well, I had always this thing in the back of my mind that said to me, if you want to call yourself a mandolin player, I mean, you should know at least some of the traditional techniques, some of the original repertoire. Seriously, I have to find a real mandolin professor and to study with him that component, that part of the puzzle I was missing. And so I did in Italy, a real mandolin teacher.
And what did he make of your technique when you performed something for him?
Oh, this, I remember it like it was yesterday because I was, you know, coming to the class the first day with my broken Italian because back then it was like my first month in Italy. And, you know, I felt, I had my concerts, I won my competition, like I'm a mandolin player, let me play to you Bach. And he looked at me like I landed from Mars and says like, okay, this is, first of all, this is not how you hold the mandolin. This is not how you hold the pick. Take this mandolin, take that pick, use these strings and hold it this way. So for half a year, I remember just playing a G major scale in all the classes. So it was a big practice for me in like, okay, now you have to put your ego, lock it in the other room and just play a G major scale for half a year.
Like a first year student.
Yeah.
Right, so he's pulling you apart and putting you back together again. And,
yes, and that was fantastic. That was priceless.
Was it? It wouldn't have felt so at the time, though, I'm sure. It would have been felt...
No, immediately it felt like... you know, at this moment you have to decide. It's so extreme. It's such an opportunity to take apart everything that you learn and reconstruct it again. And I learned so much. And thinking that you know everything, no. Take it apart, dissolve the machine, and try to construct it back. And it's much better, actually.
But how far back does the mandolin go? Does it go back to ancient times?
Yes, indeed. I mean, not the mandolin itself. Musical instruments are not invented. There is an evolution of music instruments. So the concept of a plucked string instrument, a string attached to wood that you pluck either with your finger or with a piece of bone or with a piece of wood or with whatever it is really something that is common to all the ancient musical traditions. It's the sitar in India, it's the balalaika in Russia, it's charango in Bolivia, it's the oud in Arabic music, it's the bouzouki in Greece, it's tamburica in Croatia, it's the pipa in China, it's the koto in Japan. Like every musical culture all around the world has as a main instrument a plucked string instrument. So, for example, oud, the Arabic much more ancient instrument, which means in Arabic wood. They call the instrument sometimes the material they're made from. So oud is wood in Arabic, and that's the most popular instrument in Arabic music. In Arabic, when you want to say the oud, you say al-oud. So al-oud travels to Italy, becomes lute, travels to Spain, becomes laud, which still is a folk plucked string instrument in Spanish culture. And in the Philippines, laud. It's a very popular instrument in, you know, Spanish Empire places. That becomes lute. The mandolin itself, another example is the Persian instrument called the tar. That's the most popular instrument in Persian music, which literally means a string. So dotar is an instrument with two strings. Setar is an instrument with three strings. The Indian sitar literally means 30 strings. Because C is 13, tar is string. So katar, shahar is four strings, became guitar in Europe, chitarra in Italian. It came to Italy in the Renaissance from a French instrument called mandora, and the Italian heard the soft R as L, call it mandola, and mandolino is a small mandola. I think it was mostly associated with like nobility and as an educational instrument. So a little bit like the harp or the harpsichord, young maidens in the Medici court used to play the mandolin. Mm. It was a salon instrument, at least back in the days. It was much smaller also. So that's why in the beginning of it, the birth of it, it was mostly associated as a amateur educational, like appropriate musical education for the young aristocrat maiden.
So why did you, after you finished your studies in Italy, why did you choose to move to Berlin?
Well, I stayed in Italy from when I was 22 or 3 for 8 years. At that time, I started to realize, also touring a lot in Europe, that something very special is happening in Berlin. It felt a little bit like the city is going through a phase which we don't know how long it will last, which is very exciting, which attracts all kind of creative minds from all over the world to the city to create, to live, to be inspired. It's a little bit like the La Belle Époque, you know, of Paris in the beginning of the 20th century. There was a phase of 20 years where all the composers, Stravinsky, Ravel, Debussy, Satie, Bartok, writers like Hemingway, painters, Picasso, they all lived in the same neighborhood. They all went to the same cafes. They all talked to each other.
And Berlin's like that now.
I feel that this is the time of Berlin for that. You know, it's a city that were celebrating dogmas for the last 100 years until the wall came down in 1989. It always had a tension of opposed dogmas with the wall in the middle. So imagine the amount of tension that the city had to bury, and then one day, tuck, this wall goes down. And it's cosmic. From that moment, the city kind of abandoned its dogmas and entering a new phase. And on that burned soil, suddenly fresh grass start to grow. And I think that's why it attracted a lot of artists, because there was suddenly a space for it.
It's a haunted place, though, haunted by its history for obvious reasons. And this brings me to a performance you did in 2009 at Wannsee Villa, just outside of Berlin. This is the villa, very pleasant, lovely place, where Nazis met and agreed upon the final solution to the Jewish people of Europe. And you performed there. What was the idea behind the concert there?
Yes, that was the... Actually, on the day, on the anniversary of the Wannsee Conference, it was an Israeli ensemble Mitar, of Israeli and Jewish music in the very same room where they signed the final solution, the execution of the entire Jewish population in Europe. It was an incredible day. It was so charging, so difficult to be in that place.
Did you approach it with a bit of dread, in a way, sort of going into that space?
Yeah, of course. I mean, it's January, so it's cold, and the place is beautiful, and the lake was frozen. And you have this contrast of beautiful villa, amazing place, but the knowledge of what happened in that room, it changed the energy of the place forever.
The house itself, the walls of the place.
For me, yeah, in my mind, yes. Because I felt so uncomfortable. If I landed from Mars, as I mentioned before, and went there, I didn't know anything about the history. I don't know. It's a good question if I had a feeling of the same, you know, energetic thing. But of course, it was very disturbing to play there and very moving, especially with a piece that I played there, which was by a Jewish composer, Baal Shem. I'm Jewish. This is part of my heritage. It's part of my history. It's not like I don't think about it while I live in Berlin, or I don't put importance to it.
What were you thinking while you were playing?
Well, I tried to understand on that moment why is the energy so bad in this place. It's not the walls that were built before the conference. It's not the trees that were planted way before anything of that happened. It's not the lake that carried the guilt. So what is it? It's just the energy of the place. And I started to feel that by playing this music in those walls and the sounds are bouncing from the walls, there is a correction, there is a purification of the energy. There is something also, I looked around me, there is something healing in spreading beauty, humanism through music in those difficult places.
And when you finished and you had the applause, what was different?
It's interesting because the first we filmed it for a documentary and there was no applause. There was no audience. And I remember playing the last note and just staying there for 20 seconds in silence without being able really to move and just processing what I've just experienced. It went throughout the day, and the end of the day, actually, there was audience coming to the final concert, which was also filmed. It had already a very different energy to it. But yeah, you could feel it also from the audience part, whether they were Germans or Jews or Israelis or other people that came to witness this concert, this event, that it's not a normal concert. And there is an element of correction, you know, of a process happening throughout the evening, the concert.
Avi, when you perform with the mandolin, what is the mandolin to you? Is it like another arm or a part of you or a device? What is it to you?
It's funny. Sometimes I have to, on stage, I have to remind myself, you're holding an instrument. It's like a pipe that flows the music from one point to the audience.
Aside from playing Bach, Vivaldi on stage, you also perform folk music from Great Eastern European folk traditions, like Georgian folk music and Bulgarian folk music. I'd love you to play one of these Bulgarian pieces.
Oh, with pleasure.
What's this called?
It's called Bucimiş. It's a Bulgarian dance, folk dance. Like all Bulgarian music, it has a very odd and beautiful rhythm. It's in 15/16. Normal European music would go 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4. So the Bulgarian go, like, count to 15.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15. 1, 2, 3,
exactly.
4, like that.
Just much faster.
I don't even know how you begin to play like that. I'd love to hear. What does the song title mean?
It's a sort of a poisonous plant.
Okay. Thank you. Avi, it's been such a pleasure speaking with you. And thank you so much for sharing your story and playing such gorgeous music today. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.